Hello and welcome to the Open Systems Media webcast titled Safety Certification, Key to Sharing the Sky for Avionics and UAVs. My name is John McHale, Group Editorial Director with Military Embedded Systems Magazine and moderator for today's event. Our speakers today are Vance Hilderman, CEO for AFusion, Mark Hermeling, Senior Director of Product Marketing at Gramatech, and Robert Day, Vice President of Marketing for Link Software Technologies. Now for some short bios of our speakers. Vance is CEO of AFusion, which is a safety-critical consultancy comprising advanced consulting services in software and systems development, including training, mentoring, and outsourcing. Their primary focus is safety-critical aviation and automotive, embracing standards such as DO-178C, ISO 26262, DO-254, and also DO-297, and ARP-4754A, and many, many more. He's also the co-founder and CEO from inception through successful sale 10 years later in 1990 of TechSci, which was later sold to ENEA. He's also the founder of, in 2005, of High Rely Incorporated, will continue specialization in safety critical aviation, transportation, and strategic consulting. Since 1995, he's authored many technical white papers and magazine articles that have been published worldwide. He's also co-author of a best-selling book titled Avionics Certification, a complete guide to DO-178 and DO-254. All royalties from that book go to charity. Our next speaker is Mark Hermeling, Senior Director of Product Marketing for Gramatech. Mark has 15-plus years of experience in software development, tooling, operating systems, virtualization and networking technology, and safe and secure embedded and real-time systems. He has worked on projects building automotive, networking, aerospace, and defense and industrial devices in North America, Europe, and Asia. At Gramatech, he directs Gramatech's commercial software product and business development efforts. Prior to joining Gramatech, he worked for Wind River Systems, Zilligsoft, and IBM Rational. Mark holds a Master of Science degree in Computing Science from Eindhoven University of Technology for research into timing constraints overlaid on object-oriented languages. And our third speaker, Robert Day, who's the Vice President of Marketing at Link Software Technologies, where he's responsible for all global external and internal marketing functions. With more than 20 years in the embedded industry, he has more recently in the security industry, he has combined these worlds to help meet the security needs of the connected embedded world, which is better known as the Internet of Things. Based in San Jose, California, Robert is a graduate of the University of Brighton, England, where he earned a Bachelor of Science degree in Computer Science. Our sponsors for today's event are AFusion, Gramatech, and Link Software Technologies. And now for some short housekeeping announcements. This and all Open Systems Media webcasts are copyrighted and may not be recorded or used in any way without the express written consent of Open Systems Media. Today's webcast will consume about 40 to 45 minutes, leaving the remaining time for the question and answer session. And now I want to point out some important buttons on your screen. First, please take note of the Enlarge Slides button. By clicking on this button, you'll be able to view the slides in full screen mode. You can use the Download Slide button to view the slides as a PDF to see them larger. Next important button I want you to look at is the Forward to a Friend button, which enables you to email a friend to register for this event. And finally, the last button I want you to look at is the On Your Console window, allows you to enter questions in real time. And we'll do our best to address these questions during the closing Q&A session. If you have a question that is intended for a specific speaker, please note so at the beginning of your question. Otherwise, we'll hand out the questions equally to our speakers. If you have a question pertaining to the webcast operation itself, one of our technicians will respond back to you during the webcast. Please note that as much as we'd like to, we may not get to all of your questions today. In that case, we'll only get back to you after the webcast with more information. This webcast will be archived online and be available for 1 year, but also be an MP3 version of the event available. And now I'm pleased to turn over to our first speaker, Vance Hilderman. Vance, take it away.
Thanks very much, John. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, everyone. It's a terrific webinar we have lined up here. This is about safety certification. Really, we speakers are going to try to provide you the keys to sharing the sky successfully for avionics and UAVs. Unless you've been asleep for several years, you know that UAVs are truly becoming paramount in all of our lives. As John mentioned, we've got a fusion. Gramatech and Link, some really strong companies. You'll hear more about that later on. So let's dive in. You know how these work. We like to start our little webinar sessions really making sure that you get a lot of value. So in a quick 45 minutes, we're going to cover these things. Let's have a little quiz and see how you do in 45 minutes. It's simple. True, false, 50-50. Better odds than Las Vegas, and frankly, we need better odds than that to fly UAVs safely. So let's begin with the quiz. Number one, true or false? UAVs and commercial aircraft are simply too different to share the skies safely. True or false? Number two, security is important. However,
sufficient tools and processes don't yet exist to provide that security. Number three, careful manual software analysis is mandatory for avionics quality. Number four, civil standards like DO-178, DO-254 are simply too rigorous for UAVs. And the last question, number five, UAVs are acceptably safe using common consumer tools and processes. Interesting. Five questions. Let's dive in, see if we can understand the answers. We certainly will be covering them. To begin with, let's take a look at the challenges. You've all tuned in, and it looks like we've got many dozens of countries and time zones represented, many different interests, but we're all interested in building UAVs. So let's acknowledge that UAVs truly have a very rapid development cycle, especially consumer UAVs. The old days of 5, 10, 15 years to develop a civil aircraft truly don't apply to UAVs. Next, UAVs, frankly, have less development dollars. We're not spending $5, $10 billion like a 787, A380 in development of UAVs, fractions of that. Therefore, for many folks, there seems to be less perceived safety need. You get what you pay for, right? Interesting. Next one, UAVs. Truly, there is less FAA, Federal Aviation Administration, and the European counterpart, EASA, less involvement than civil aviation. That is true. Now, UAV security is increasingly important, just as it is for anything that flies, be it aircraft, helicopters, missiles. UAVs can be kidnapped. They transmit sensitive data. So truly, security is increasingly important to ensure that safety. Next, UAV reliability. It needs to be cost effective. So we're really pleased to have Gravitech and Lynx, who make terrific tools for UAV reliability, here. How can we use these tools and processes to make UAVs cost effective? And the last question, think about this, folks. If a major UAV and an airliner crash, it's probably going to be blamed on the UAV. Will that be the tipping point? Well, it certainly would. So we need action before this happens. Okay. Now, how do we proceed with that? Let's take a look. This slide is interesting. This is the aviation safety history through 2012. This is when mainstream UAVs began arriving. Think back to 10 years ago, back when your smartphone wasn't quite as smart. Okay. We're a Snapchat Instagram user back then. Well, you know, we didn't have a lot of UAVs back then either. Today, it's exploded. But look, the number of civil aircraft is increasing linearly. Our safety is gradually improving. However, we have massive increase in complexity, lines of code, more crowded airspace. How can we possibly provide a reliable framework with which to operate UAVs? Well, it's easy. It takes a process, a framework, an understanding. First, what is safety? It's a quantified impact of an anomalous behavior. Okay? So how safe is it? Well, in civil aviation, we truly apply mathematics. It's basic high school, college mathematics in the form of fault trees, safety assessment, mean time between failures. There's a little subjectivity, but we use these standards, the ARP 4761, 54. When you go in an aircraft, folks, you are truly safer mathematically, and you can look at the numbers. You're safer in that aircraft than you are anywhere on the ground. Fascinating. Okay? So we use that safety process with a system process, ARP 4754. And then we have supporting processes for aviation data, security, DO-326. We have aviation software embedded in the air, DO-178, on the ground, 278. Hardware, DO-254. So these are processes that all of our commercial aircraft and many of our private aircraft are flying today. So gradually, UAVs are starting to apply these as well. Now, that cost-effective aspect is an interesting one. We want to control software effects. We want to assess them. If we look at this slide, it's interesting. Just because we have a bug doesn't mean it's a fault, okay? Just because we have a fault doesn't mean we have a system failure. And just because we have a system failure doesn't mean we have a failure condition. So what we want to do, it's just like you software engineers out there, you want to handle the exception locally, don't keep propagating it. Well, it's the same with faults. With tools and processes, we can first prevent most of the faults. Secondly, we can detect almost all the remainder. And then finally, we truly have to mitigate the remainder. So it's those processes that we have to follow. Now, how do we do that? Well, it's interesting. First, take a look at the relative safety and productivity. All of us are cost constrained. None of us have enough money. Are these tools, processes, cost effective? Well, if you consider what the cost of a defect is, engineering labor, cost per hour, they truly are. If we look at the old traditional waterfall or iterative method, they're fairly efficient, but a lot of defects slip through. Then we improve to object-oriented or agile processes, and it gets even better. But we still have defects. So if we look at personal software processes, team processes, they're pretty good. DO-178 is interesting. This is what our commercial aircraft are using, and increasingly our UAVs. Can it be cost-effective? Well, it's very good at defect prevention, but folks, it's not cheap. But you know what's not cheap? It should be cost-effective. The initial cost increase is a little bit, 15 to 40%, but usually that's recovered by the end of the project. It's definitely recovered on the second project. How do we do that efficiently? Well, we call this the green snake, and look where Gramatech, Lynx, and Effusion fit in there. We start in the upper left with a safety assessment process, and for UAVs, we make that fairly straightforward. Then we have a quality assurance process. We build system black box requirements. Then we build our lean plans and standards, a framework, so that our knowledge doesn't go out the door every day when our engineers go home. We have a defined process. Then we can trace that process. We have configuration management, then audits, and we gradually decompose the software requirements, the high-level, low-level design. We have testing, and then a series of audits so we know where we're at any stage. And this is the optimal process that we use at Effusion with our UAV and our civil aviation clients. And as you'll see, the Gramatech and Lynx tools fit right in there to make this efficient and productive along the way. Okay, now, to achieve safety with UAVs, we need to consider three things. First, we need to adopt a lean but a safe, defined process methodology. We can use a subset of 178C or the lesser criticality levels, for example, C and D, with a later upgrade path to level A. Safety system process of 4754A and DO-254. Then DO-326 also. We address security and safety with design and tools, the processes, the frameworks. That's what we do at Effusion here. That's what Gramatech and Lynx will be telling about how they fit in as well. So we can use the new DO-326 for security of aviation. Combine that with static code analysis, and Gramatech will tell you about that. And then a provable RTOS and the security frameworks with Lynx, and you have a good solution. Then you have to analyze those steps and select those tools, the processes, the training, and that's where we come in. So you can analyze the gaps. You don't have to start over. You can reuse what you have for the most part, but you have to have a good understanding of what your gaps are, a good selection of tools and those safety critical processes, and then security guidelines. The good thing is you're not inventing anything here. You're refining the best-in-class processes and improving them and working it with a safe UAV environment. So that's a quick introduction, folks. At this time, I'd like to turn it back over to John, who will introduce our next speaker, Mark. John, it's all yours.
Thank you, Vince. Well done, as always. And before I turn over to our next speaker, I just want to remind the audience, start sending in your questions now. If you saw something during Vance's presentation that you'd like to ask a question on or follow up on, write it in there now. We'll get to it as soon as we start the Q&A, which will be after our third speaker. And now I'd like to turn it over to Mark Hermeling. Mark, it's all yours.
Thank you very much, John. Thank you very much, Vance. A very good setup on safety processes. So John, Vance already spoke about static analysis and how it fits into that safety process to deliver you more safe avionics software. And one of the things to keep in mind is that there's always a bit of a balance between safety and the cost to safety and efficiency, and Vance already touched on that. Static analysis is one of those technologies that really helps you get the most on the safety scale and the most on the efficiency scale. And what static analysis really does, if you look at it from a 30,000-foot perspective, is that there's three different topics. Number one is validating coding standards. So validating coding standards is important. You have an engineering team, and you typically have a number of really strong performers in that engineering team, and you typically have a number of less strong performers, maybe a couple of newcomers, maybe a couple of graduates. And they may not necessarily have the decades of experience that you really want somebody to have when they build avionics software. So what coding standards allow you to do is to write up the knowledge of these people that have the experience, and static analysis tools can then validate them. And as soon as one of your newcomers starts writing source code and he has a module completed and he wants to check it into your repository, static analysis will help them improve their source code because it forces them to follow these coding standards and gives them nice fatherly advice around how they can improve their source code. So that's one side, the validation of the coding standards. The second thing is that static analysis can be a bug hunter. The language that we use for embedded systems are very, very powerful, very, very efficient. However, they have these corner cases around undefined behavior, things such as buffer overruns and null pointer dereferences that we really don't like, but we have to live with them. Static analysis can find these really, really early on in your software development lifecycle and can help you resolve them earlier. So undefined behavior, API misuse is another really good category to look at. It has to do with usage of a library such as a socket library or maybe malloc and free where you don't adhere to the rules for that library. So maybe you do a send before you open the socket or you do a send after you close the socket. Static analysis can find these as well as suspicious code, dead code, unused variables. And the really nice thing with static analysis is that it can find those not just in small little snippets of code, it can find that all the way through your program. So it does what we call a whole program analysis. It takes the entire source code base and then runs analysis on this code base and tries to find paths through that source code that can happen during runtime and then find violations in those paths. And the third category here is that static analysis provides objective, actionable input to the team. So it uploads tedious tasks from your development team, right? Everybody has sat into code review meetings where you go, well, this could this happen? Could that happen? Well, static analysis can do that thinking for you and can provide you with a list of areas that you have to look at, a list of areas that you have to review before submitting that code into your repository, and provide that list as an objective list of input that the team then has to take action on. It doesn't completely remove manual inspection, but it helps your team drive that manual inspection process. So looking at it from a types of checks perspective, everybody is familiar with buffer overflows and null pointer dereferences, or at least everybody that's written C or C++ code. But those are not the only things that static analysis can find. Most current embedded systems is all about multi-core, right? Whether it's multi-core, multi-press processor, multi-threaded, there's multiple things that happen at these systems at the same time. And concurrency issues are really easy to slip in. Concurrency issues happen when you have multiple different threads that access global variables and that don't protect those global variables correctly, such that one thread is making an update while the other thread is maybe reading. And you try to avoid those concurrency issues by having really good tests. However, you can never test completely. So the nice part of static analysis, again, this is offline. It can do this before you actually run the software. It can compute through your shared variables, compute through your threads, make a list, create a matching of what possible scenarios could happen, and then flag these warnings for you. So it's a really good way if you have a single-threaded application that you want to make multi-threaded, static analysis is the first thing that you should throw at it. And then the other topic here that is interesting is the user file or network data taint handling. Everybody processes data. Everybody takes in data from a network or from a user. But you can never trust that data, right? If you get some data in over a network connection and you use that data, maybe it's a number, you use that to index into an array without actually checking whether the value of that number, that attribute that you get in, is correct, then you can get a lot of different safety and security issues, right? That's basically what happened with Heartbleed. A network value was taken in, and without that value being properly validated, it was used to access an array. And then the last one I want to touch on here quickly is the domain-specific invariance. And this comes back to your development team again. Domain-specific invariants are things that have to do with your architecture. So maybe you have a set of data, and you have an API around it, and you can only access that data through that API. Anything else is not allowed. You can write that up in documents. You can write that up in presentations. But guaranteed, if you have a software development team that comes in fresh, they're going to violate that rule. You can actually write up these rules in what we call domain-specific checks and have your static analysis tool validate them. Again, if you have new guys that come in, as soon as they make that violation, you capture it right away and they can correct it, as opposed to correcting it much later in the software development process. So static analysis is great. Static analysis is wonderful. However, you have to realize that static analysis has a number of different attributes that you can fine-tune in the process. And this goes around three parameters called recall, precision, and performance. Recall is how much of the real problems do you find? And if you miss a problem, we call that a false negative, a true problem in your source code that was left in by the static analysis program. Static analysis is not perfect. It cannot find everything, so there will always be a certain amount of false negatives. Precision is, if a tool provides you with a warning, how many of those warnings are truly actual problems in your source code or are due to the tool misunderstanding something? We call those false positives. And the last one is performance. In safety-certified systems, you really want to crank up that recall. So as you crank up the recall, you're going to need more performance. You're going to need more compute power to compute through your source code. But as a result as well, you'll get a few more false positives. And we'll talk in a little bit on how to handle these false positives. So looking at it from a process perspective, static analysis starts with artifacts. On the left-hand side of this slide, you see artifacts can be source code or can be binaries. And you feed those binaries into an automated process that parses and creates a model of this information and then runs analysis on that model. Completely automated. It'll give you a list of warnings that are prioritized. So the tool will tell you, here is maybe 1,000 warnings in your source code that you should assess, and it prioritizes them based on how likely it is that they occur and how dangerous it is when they occur. And then you go into a manual process where for every warning, you have to make an assessment. So you have to say, warning number one, yes, we believe this is a problem. This can happen in this and this configuration. Priority one, problem warning number two, we don't think this can happen because of rule 16. This can only happen when the landing gear is down, those type of things. And those assessments that you make are persistent. They stay with the source code base. So if you say, no, this is not a problem, this can never happen, the warning will disappear and you will not see it again. And then, of course, in the end, this will lead to a number of different fixes. So where do you apply this in the software development process? Multiple different places. I like to recommend my customers that when they start coding, you apply static analysis right away. So there's a bunch of source code written, run it through your static analysis tool, and make sure that you quench those warnings, that you kind of squash those bugs as early as possible, right? Everybody knows the sooner you resolve a bug, the cheaper it is. Then when these warnings come up, you use that in the code review process as well. Make sure that your team reviews them, that everybody agrees, everybody learns together. And then lastly, when you have your test, this is when you start using those domain-specific checks and those concurrency checks to make sure that your entire program still matches the correctness criteria that you have set. So three different places: during your coding, during your code reviews, and then during the testing. So with that, let me pass it back to John.
Thank you, Mark. Excellent presentation. Just a reminder to the audience, if you have questions on Mark or Vance's presentation, send them in now. We'll get to them after our next speaker is finished during the Q&A session. And now I'll turn it over to our next speaker, Robert Day. Robert, take it away.
Thank you, John. And thank you to Vance and Mark for kind of setting a nice scene for how, you know, we can really look at protecting and, you know, managing safety criticality in unmanned vehicles and how they can share the skies. What I'm really going to focus on is safety critical avionics software, the sort of foundation for building safety critical software systems. And, you know, what the way we see the world is, if you use the safety critical avionics software that's used in commercial avionics, in UAVs, then you've got a much better chance of having the same level of safety that we have in traditional commercial. And so things like avionics certified real-time operating systems could really help minimize the, you know, the fault conditions that could occur in a flight system in a UAV. If we look specifically at DO-178C certified RTOSs, and especially that have time and space partitioning A-rank 653, this not only can prevent any fault conditions from occurring, but also can help manage them. So, you know, you can get as close to perfect software for safety as you can, but if a fault condition does arise for whatever reason, to be able to contain that fault condition is very useful in avionics systems. So if you develop UAV, you know, flight software using these standards operating systems and processes, then what you end up with is basically a similar level of safety criticality for both the commercial avionics and the UAVs. Now, assuming we haven't quite got to real autonomous UAVs, UAVs are still being piloted. So someone's still controlling the UAV. And so assuming that, you know, you have these similar safety practices for the remote pilots as you do to commercial pilots, and assuming that you have the same level of safety critical flight software and a lot of the analysis being done on that software, then there really is an opportunity for commercial airlines and avionics to share the sky with UAVs. If only it was that simple. There is a but, and the but, as I think Vance certainly mentioned, is what about security? Is just having something safe, especially something that's connected to the, in some way to the outside world, certainly between a flying thing and a control thing, security has to be something we have to consider. And so all the parts of a UAV system, from the actual UAV itself through to the ground control system and also the communication links between them, really do need to be protected, because a single security threat could compromise the whole system. And so really, unlike IT security, where we've got all these nice kind of bolt-ins, we really need to build the security into the UAV, and that really needs to help isolate the things that do the flight critical systems from other UAV functions. As the UAVs get more and more complex, more and more functionality is going to go around the thing that's actually flying. We're going to be, you know, sensors, video feeds, whatever. And so having the security to actually kind of encase the safety stuff and separate it from the other functions is, you know, really quite an essential part. However, that's not enough, because if you've got a ground control station that's controlling the UAV and that gets compromised, then basically a cyber threat could then establish control of the UAV and do something particularly nasty and pose a safety hazard in the sky. So, okay, we're protecting the UAV and the safety critical stuff. We're protecting the ground control station. Well, there's also the communication link between them, and we really have to make sure that that doesn't get compromised in some shape or form. So unfortunately, security really does have a very key effect on the safety of UAVs and whether they really can fly in the commercial sky. That does beg the question, you know, are UAV threats real? Well, there have been many public threats. There have been hijackings of UAVs. A lot of it's been more in the defense world, which is where a lot of the larger UAVs have been flying. But the threats are real. So what can we do about it? Well, what you can actually do is you can mix safety critical and security critical software platforms through your UAV and your ground control stations. And so you can take some foundational security technology, okay, and you can actually use that to protect the UAV and the ground control station against any type of malicious threat. The threats that are going to happen to a UAV system are not going to be your common hacks. They're going to be sophisticated. They're going to be often what's termed sort of 0 hour or 0 day. They're going to be targeted. And so you can't protect against that using traditional, IT antivirus, because, these things are not running the same operating systems we run in a PC. So what can we do? Well, we can basically take a security technology that already exists, that was actually built for defense applications, and use that to protect the UAS or the UAV without compromising either the safety or the real-time nature of these systems. And the technology is called a separation kernel hypervisor. What it actually does is it offers isolated autonomous virtual domains on a single hardware platform, which house different functions and protect them either from each other or from any threats coming into the system. What this means in the reality of a UAV is you can actually put safety critical software systems and you can run them without any interference next to general purpose operating systems and other applications all on the same UAV. You can also restrict communication that happens between them. So the same technology that gives you these isolated autonomous runtimes can actually allow and protect the communication that goes with it. One of the things you can actually do is actually bring in unidirectional flows, data flows, either between different virtual domains on the UAV or even between the UAV and the ground control station. If you're just feeding information back, you can make a channel that's unidirectional. These are often termed data diodes. And you can also look at, well, let's bring some kind of nice encryption functionality in for that data. So we really need to protect both the data in motion as it goes to and from the UAV and the ground control station, but also any information that's either stored at the ground control station or stored on the UAV should be encrypted and protected too. So this might all seem somewhat obvious, but it isn't being done in the way that it should be done now with UAVs. And so to give you an example, I've got a little diagram here which sort of shows how you can use this technology, security technology, to protect both the UAV, i.e. the thing that flies, and the ground control station, the thing that flies it, and allows you to isolate the safety critical real-time operating systems from the general purpose operating systems on the bird. And then when you get down to the ground control station, the different functions that that ground control station has, you can isolate that too. So you can isolate the video feed coming from the UAV in its own virtual domain from the control that the pilot is actually controlling the UAV. So you're building these encrypted channels that are separated from one another, both on the ground control station and on the UAV itself. And so what we're finding now is that you can take the safety critical system, which kind of assume is the way that we're going to have autonomous UAVs and commercial avionics flying in the same airspace, and add this extra level of military grade security to make sure that they don't get compromised. And so with that, we're going to sort of give you a little summary of what you've heard over the last 30 minutes or so, and really for unmanned vehicles to fly in the same airspace at the same time as the commercial avionics, you really have to start looking at adopting a safety development process when you build your UAV. You should look at different software tools and technologies to basically help with that safety and also offer the security to protect it too. And that's really been the crux of you know, what we've been talking about today. So now I'm actually going to hand it back to Vance, who will give you the answers to his quiz at the beginning of the event. Vance, over to you.
Robert, thank you so very much. Folks, that went by very quickly. I see that you're all still hanging in there. You're probably very curious about how your answers were when you tried to evaluate those 40 minutes ago. We heard some good speakers who explained to us, Mark and Robert, question number one, it's false. And you're probably looking ahead, they're all false. Number one, UAVs and commercial aircraft are actually very, very similar. If we look at the flight controls, the propulsion, many of the avionics systems, okay, they are based on what we largely have been developing for over 100 years with commercial aircraft, with today's ADS-B, with satellites, with ground tracking, with knowledge of safety, with the tools. There's no reason we can't use these very tools that Mark and Robert told you about from Lynx and Gramatech in both environments, and that's actually the ideal case. So they can coexist. Number two, security is important, but sufficient tools and processes don't yet exist. No, they do exist. And just like UAVs, the adoption, the implementation, and deployment has expanded dramatically. The same thing's true with the tools, okay? 20 years ago for civil aviation, so many of these things were done manually. And that's just simply not cost-effective. It's not repeatable. It's not reusable. With rapid deployment, especially typified by UAVs, we really want to reuse those tools. So the processes, the frameworks for safe aviation, cost-effective, the tools really do coexist. Number three, careful manual software analysis is mandatory for avionics quality. Folks, they spent over 100 person years with very limited random access memory on Apollo. Those folks were smart. You're smart. But those folks spent hundreds of years. You don't have hundreds of years. We don't use manual processes anymore. Then you use a hammer and nail to build a house. We use tools. With software, we really use those automated tools and processes, the frameworks for managing requirements, assessing safety, rapid deployment of frameworks. If we don't change the software, we really don't have to do a lot of work the next time. We do retesting, redeployment, and we prove we're using it in a consistent environment, but that requires one thing, a foundation of safety. All of you know about personal fitness. If you're like me, you were probably more personally fit at one time in your life, 5 or 10 years ago, and that's normal. But you know that personal fitness is a recipe of nutrition, of cardio exercise, flexibility, muscular exercise. It's also about diet, about sleep, about peace. Which is more important? They all are. With UAV safety, we really need that whole framework, and it is cost-effective, especially considering the alternative. And the last question, UAVs are acceptably safe only using common commercial consumer tools and processes. No, that's not the case. You can have some limited safety, like experimental aircraft or a home-built car, but no one would send our kids off to a midnight milk run or college with a homemade car without any lights or safety equipment or seatbelts. The same thing's true with UAVs. They are potentially dangerous. They're highly necessary. We're all looking forward to the day when we get UAV drop-offs of everything we need. Maybe the UAV will pick us up and take us to the beach on a nice sunny day someday. It's going to happen, folks. Well, we have those tools out there now, and they're specialty tools for safe, high-reliability aviation. Use them. It's been a pleasure. At this time, I'd like to turn it over to John. It looks like there's many questions you posed from around the world. John?
Thank you, Vance. Smooth as always. Just if you want to contact these guys, the information is there on that slide. Now we'll go right to our Q&A session. And the first question I have from the audience is for Robert Day. Robert, how do you ensure that when using hypervisor technology, the hypervisor itself is safe and secure?
Thanks, John. That's a really good question. So I guess most people really don't see a hypervisor as being technology that is in any way safe or secure. Virtualization is often seen as being secure just by the very nature of, well, if I stick something in a virtual machine, oh, that means it can't get tampered with. It's not actually the case. So honestly, most hypervisors out there could not go in a safety or a security system. They couldn't go through the, you know, the rigorous DO-178 processes. However, if you take a technology that was designed to be safe and secure in the first place, then that can be. And the separation kernel hypervisor is a very lightweight, thin hypervisor that really just all it does is does the isolation between the different domains. All you have to go through the certification on is prove that the isolation is correct, a bit like safety partitioning in a 178 real-time operating system. So the way to ensure that the hypervisor itself is safe and secure is really make sure that the hypervisor was designed for that purpose in the first place, and that's what the separation kernel hypervisor was designed for.
Thank you, Robert. Next question is for Vance. I use Pure Agile in our UAV development. Do you have any suggestions I should consider?
Well, that's a great question. You know, kind of like UAVs, we've seen the explosion in agile and lean development. It really has much, much going for it. Now, in a safety-critical world, a lot of people think it really doesn't belong. It's kind of like eating potato chips on a strict athlete diet, right? Well, you know, if you do a lot of other things right, you can use that agile and have a couple of potato chips during the break as well. What we do is take a subset of Agile, and we make sure we have a little bit of documentation. So think of it this way. Adopt a lean Agile process, but instead of relying on the same people coming in every day, which is the typical scenario, you'll change team members, think about what would happen if you rotated your engineers from team to team so they didn't have the legacy of the Scrum, the knowledge. What would you need? Well, you need communication. You need an ability to assess and manage a framework. You need to be able to assess the transitions, the handoffs. You'd probably want some basic frameworks of processes for checklists and traceability to know what was done, a proven safety record. Frankly, the things that if you owned the company, you would want in place just to ensure that all the knowledge didn't leave every day at 5 or 10 p.m., depending on where you work. And you'd institute those processes. And that's something we do at Effusion, and it's quite slick. We don't do it in the same way for civil aviation, where we have to formally apply, but we do with UAVs, and it's really the best of both worlds. It's a good question. Thanks, Tom.
Okay. Next question from the audience. This one's for Mark. What is meant by input to a static code analyzer to the binary? How does that work?
Excellent question. Thank you very much. So static analysis, by definition, means analyzing something without executing it, right? So dynamic analysis is where you test something, so you actually execute it and you go through certain test harnesses. The power of static analysis comes from the fact that you have an algorithm that goes through the element that you're trying to analyze and tries to derive all possible execution paths, or at least as many as possible in a given time frame, and then tries to make sure that there's no latent defects in that. Now, the way that advanced static analysis does that, and certainly Gramatec has CodeSonar, its advanced static analysis tool, is that we parse the source code very, very close to the hardware. So we take the exact same source code that goes into the final product. We create a model out of that. And then on that model, we run our checkers. And that's what people are typically familiar with when you talk about static code analysis. However, it doesn't have to be source code that you parse. You can parse a binary as well. So parsing the binary has the benefit of actually having everything done, right? The binary is what will fly the UAV in the end. So if you take that binary and you parse that binary, you can create the same model as you had with source code. So you have a model, and on that model, you run the same analysis. That's one of the use cases, right? So take a binary, take the executable that would actually, in real life, fly the UAV or run your IoT system, parse it, create the model, analyze, and list all the warnings that you find, be it buffer overruns or concurrency issues, those type of things. The other really interesting use case is if you're writing source code, but you have third-party components that were delivered in binary format. So maybe you have a library that deals with communication. Maybe it's a CORBA library or a graphical user interface, those type of things that you've bought from a third party. You can actually trace your source code execution through that library and see if you have any vulnerabilities, any defects in either your source code's usage of that library or in that library itself. So you would get warnings allocated against that library or against that binary in the binary assembly code. So it works on both, and it's there's slightly different use cases for static analysis for binaries, for executables, libraries, and source code.
Thank you, Mark. Our next question is for Robert. Robert, data diode communication can be ensured by Link Secure. Can data diode link communication be ensured by Link Secure?
Yeah. So Link Secure is just a product name for the separation kernel hypervisor. It's interesting because the separation kernel hypervisor basically owns the hardware on a particular platform, and it offers resources, isolated resources, to operating systems and applications running above it. So the way to enforce unidirectional communication is by controlling, you know, which of these regions can read or write to, you know, something like a shared memory region. So you're basically enforcing unidirectionality, i.e. data diode, as things communicate between these different virtual machines. Where it kind of gets interesting is when you start trying to do unidirectional communications on things like TCP/IP, which by its very nature is bidirectional. And so what you can do is create a kind of a system whereby you actually control the unidirectionality across the virtual machines. So even though the virtual machine that's connected to the outside world is basically bidirectional, having that initial stopping point and then the unidirectional going the other way, you can actually make sure that the safety critical system is never compromised by the direction that comes that way, even though the actual communication over such as TCP/IP isn't unidirectional. So that's kind of difficult to do without a diagram, to be honest with you, but that's kind of as good as I can get, and I'm quite happy to answer any of those questions offline too.
Excellent. And now our next question from the audience. This one's for Mark. I have great test and 100% code coverage. Why would I still need static analysis?
You'd wonder, eh? So great test, great code coverage. That's awesome. Congratulations. It's probably been very expensive for you to get there. And static analysis helps in the process of actually getting there, right? So when you do your testing and you're looking at your code coverage and you're writing more test cases, you find defects and you have to send them back to your development team, static analysis could have found some of those defects way earlier in the development process, right? So it would have made it cheaper for you to get to your 100% code coverage. The second part is that with 100% code coverage, you've just proven that you've covered every piece of code. You haven't proven that you really have covered all execution paths through those pieces of code. So there could still be some paths in there where static analysis can find problems, and I'd rather have you find them before you fly your software rather than after.
Excellent. Thank you. Next question from the audience, and this one is not assigned. So given the high and rising cost of certification, are you considering any methods that do not require 100% line coverage or 100% decision coverage, et cetera? Who would like to grab that one?
I can do that one. This is Vance Hilderman here from Fusion. You know, that's an interesting topic. It actually ties into an FAA meeting that many of us in the certification business were kind of invited to, meaning we have to go. But there's a movement afoot, and it's quite interesting. Think about it. If you're a couch potato and you want to get a gold medal, you have a big gap. But what if you're already a proven college athlete? You just haven't got the Olympic gold medal. Your gap is smaller. Well, That's what the European EASA and also the FAA is looking at. We have a process called overarching properties, and it's underway now, and you'll see some changes. Do you have a good CMMI rating? Are you at least level 3? Do you have a proven track record of developing software with proven processes? If so, then congratulations, you're a good college athlete. You're eligible for the gold medal. You don't have to go through the same boot camp training that the couch potato might have to go to. So, indeed, if you've got a small UAV, if you have certain airspace that you don't operate in, I live in Los Angeles and New York, you're not operating in Class A, Class B airspace over the nursery school at 100-foot elevation, for example, then overarching properties, or in Europe, a level of involvement, very similar activities, but different philosophy, could be employed. And the neat thing about that is you can still prevent a lot of defects. And as Mark just mentioned, with static analysis, preventing defects is much better than detecting them later. Testing itself won't, you know, dynamic testing won't remove all the defects because it doesn't find them all. It's much better to prevent defects than to fix them. And so if you have these overarching properties of good conditioning, you know, for your software, good physical conditioning, processes, frameworks, then you don't have to be so intent about proving every line of code was covered by tests. Why? Because you have the process. The testing has already been done at the static level. So great question.
Thanks, Vance. Next question from the audience. This one is for Mark. Do you have an ROI about static analysis process compared to standard test processes?
Yeah, we do. It all, of course, depends a little bit on a number of different assumptions, right? It depends on how complex your source code is, how large your source code base is, what your defect density is. And then you can make up a couple of assumptions as to how much time you save by finding a defect earlier. And then you can make a really decent graph with some historical information around what the return on investment is. It's very specific per project, though, right? C code is very different from C++ code. Avionics code that is already DO178C certified is very different for something that you're building for an IoT device. So I don't have a generic number as to you'll save 20% of your development cost. But if you want to connect with me afterwards, I can easily put some numbers in a spreadsheet that you can play with a little bit yourself to kind of understand how that can help you write better software faster.
Thank you, Mark. Next question for Robert Day. The military is operating at times in civil airspace, typically authorized. Have these platforms already started adopting safety certification standards, Robert?
Yeah, so I mean, the military have their own standards, but what we're seeing is that they are really looking at adopting and using safety-certified systems. So even if they don't have to go through a 178 certification, actually using software that's been through it so they get that safety pedigree is actually being widely used now in military avionics or defense avionics. The security side of things is even more interesting because, you know, the not just are they flying in commercial airspace, but they're flying in high threat airspace, and especially, you know, military drones. And so they need to have this security because people are actually trying to attack them. And so this whole concept of safety and security in UAVs and especially in defense avionics is really kind of top priority right now, John.
Thank you, Robert. And that I have a question for you guys. Earlier this year at the Aviation Electronics Europe show, where Vance and I were both at and speaking at, some attendees were asking during a session on security why there are not standards set up for security and avionics systems like there are for the safety and the DO-17APs. Is that being developed? I mean, Vance or Mark or even Robert, do you guys have any information on that?
Vance here, I alluded to it. Let's turn it over to Mark and Robert to elaborate. We just have a couple minutes. I know. But I alluded to that on one of my early slides. I think on slide 4, I probably could have spoken more, didn't want to hog the microphone. DO-326, okay, is fairly new. It's not widely deployed yet, but it directly does address the avionic safety. The thing is, it doesn't have a lot of teeth. It's not as enforced as, say, 178, 278, 254 are. And so it's not fully deployed yet, but it's got some great knowledge. Everybody involved in UAVs should read DO-326. Okay, I think we're going to have a white paper on our site on it in a couple of weeks. It's under review. But DO-326 goes a long way for that. Robert, how about yourself? You've got some cool things you're working on with security. What are the things would you like to contribute?
Yeah, so it's really interesting. So there are almost in every safety certification thing that's going on now, whether it's avionics, whether it's automotive, whether it's transportation, whether it's industrial, there's always been these safety standards because that's what people have kind of been worried about. Well, now all of these standards are now trying to introduce, well, what about security? How does that fit in? And it's quite a challenge, and as we've seen from the 326, it's like it's a first stab at this stuff because, you know, there's a recognize that you really do need to worry about security, but how do you really put that down on paper? And that's why this, I think, is a sort of fledgling paper. But it's certainly showing the direction of safety and security and the fact that we do need standards for it. So it's a good question, John.
All right. Next question from the audience. This one's for Robert or Mark. In safety, like DO-178B development, DO-178 development test tools must have their own certification package. Do you think it would be the same for security standards like EAL 62443 or others?
Yes, they do. I mean, they have similarities, but they have differences. So for EAL and common criteria, you need security artifacts rather than safety artifacts. And I say there is some commonality, but there is also a lot of differences because they're trying to achieve a different thing.
Yeah, the goal here is all about making sure that you demonstrate that you do what you're claiming to do, right?
Yeah.
And that's what these artifacts help with.
Yeah.
Okay. It's like we have time for maybe one more question here. This one's for, looks like it's for Mark. Do I still need to do code reviews if I use static analysis tools?
Yes, you do. So static analysis will provide you with a number of warnings that I kind of covered during my section of the presentation. And it will really tell you about areas where your code is a bit shaky. And it's always good to review those areas in a code review process, especially as when you write a piece of source code and you're using or relying on code from others, you may actually use somebody else's code slightly differently than your colleague was using it. And so when you use that code, there could be that there's warning in another piece of source code that pop up, and it's really good to review those. We had a customer about 2 weeks ago. This is code. They had some code that was running for years, tens of years. And we did an analysis on it, and they found some error paths where they said, well, this cannot really happen in this configuration of the product, but we're working on the next configuration of the same code in a different product. And in that, yes, this is certainly a path that can happen, and this is something that we have to cover off. So this is in 20-year-old code. So I think static analysis is one of the things that you absolutely should use to make sure that you cover off your basis.
Excellent. And thank you, Mark. And that brings us right up to our time limit for today. Sorry we can't get to all of your questions, so I'm going to get back to you after the webcast with more information. I'd like to thank Vance, Mark, and Robert for speaking today, and AFusion, Grammatec, and Link Software Technologies for sponsoring the event. As mentioned earlier, on slide 25, you can find out contact information for all three sponsors and individuals. Please remember that this and all Open Systems Media webcasts are copyrighted and may not be recorded or used in any way without the express written consent of Open Systems Media. This webcast will be archived online today and be available for 1 year. There will also be an MP3 version of the event available. Thank you all for attending, and I look forward to seeing you on future Open Systems Media webcasts. Goodbye.